Hey, Dialogue listeners, it's Blair Hodges, and my podcast, Family Proclamations, just celebrated its first birthday. It's 1 year old, and we've spent a year on the show exploring the history and evolution of family, gender, and sexuality. I've been talking to authors of the best books on things like intergenerational trauma, children's rights, feminism, trans experiences, immigration in the United States, women's reproductive health, having an only child or having no children, living the single life, divorce, and more. And I'm excited for the next year of the show, but I wanted to try out a new name for it. The thing is, I realized that we'd actually been talking about a lot more than just family, right? We're talking about human identity and how we connect with each other. We're really talking about relationships, which includes family, but it's so much more than that. And depending on who you are, you might associate the word family with different things. So the name of the show is now Relationscapes, and I'll be publishing more thought-provoking conversations with incredible guides who will help us explore human identity and human connection on Relationscapes. It'll be pretty much like Family Proclamations. So if you're interested in fostering better relationships and understanding yourself better and understanding your connection with other people better, if diversity matters to you, if your own experience challenges traditional norms or you want to understand people who challenge traditional norms, then Relationscapes is for you. And right now, you're about to hear the first episode that was released under the name Relationscapes. This is an interview with Guinevere Turner, and she's an acclaimed screenwriter. She actually wrote the screenplay for the movie American Psycho, that Christian Bale movie that maybe you haven't seen. It's a little gory. But she was also raised in a cult called The Family, the Lyman family. And she wrote about her experiences in a memoir called When the World Didn't End. If you're a fan of Tara Westover's book Educated, then you'll definitely appreciate Guinevere Turner's book. It's incredible. It's a real page-turner. Thanks to Dialogue and the Dialogue Podcast Network for making this episode available to you all. And I invite you to directly go subscribe to Relationscapes. We've got some really great episodes coming up. This episode includes descriptions of psychological manipulation and sexual abuse. Listener discretion is advised. This is Relationscapes. I'm Blair Hodges. We're mapping out the stories and ideas that shape how we connect with each other. In this episode, our guide is Guinevere Turner.
I think beyond the disappointment, because I was really looking forward to going to Venus and living there, there was just anxiety and fear because the adults all said something was going to happen and it didn't. This isn't going to be pretty, whatever it is.
One January day in 1975, 7-year-old Guinevere Turner put on her best dress, grabbed her favorite toy, and waited for the spaceship to arrive. But the world didn't end that day, after all. And even though the cult she was being raised in carried on, Guinevere would soon find herself thrust out into the world beyond the cult, where things would actually become more nightmarish than before. In this episode, acclaimed screenwriter Guinevere Turner joins us to talk about her remarkable memoir, When the World Didn't End. Guinevere Turner, welcome to Relationscapes.
Hi, Blair. Thanks for having me.
At the start of your book, there's an author's note, and you let us know in that note that you wrote the book from the perspective of your 6-year-old self, kind of up to your 18-year-old self. One of the most striking things about your memoir is how well you're able to tap into earlier eras of yourself. You're writing from that perspective. And so I wanted you to tell us about the decision to write from there instead of writing retrospectively from your present day perspective with all of the knowledge you've gained since then. We get to experience you learning things as the book goes. So how did you decide to frame it that way?
Well, I decided to frame it that way after a lot of thinking and reading other memoirs and considering the specific challenges of my story, which is that the family that I grew up in, a cult, are still alive and well. Predominantly. And I know because I wrote this piece for The New Yorker that is also on the same subject, that when the fact checker at The New Yorker called their lawyer, they said, that's ridiculous. How can she remember any of this? She was just a kid. And so for one, I thought it would be a good idea to write from the perspective of being a kid, because in some ways it's ironclad. If I'm saying this is how I remember it, you know, I'm not saying it's science. I'm not saying it's journalism. I'm saying this is what it felt like for me. You can't call it into question. I'm not saying this is the absolute truth. I'm saying this is my experience. Also, then when I read many, many memoirs, many of which are good and come from the perspective of, you know, the adult hindsight, I personally just stylistically don't like the "if I only knew now what I know then," or "but things were about to get so much worse," or, you know, any of that. It's just it kind of takes you out of it. And I think it kind of sort of lowers the art profile of a book if you don't make a very conscious choice of a POV. This perhaps comes from my screenwriting self and background. And also because I've felt I have these diaries that I wrote back then that are, you know, obviously in the first person and are very, you can't call them into question. They're real. That's really what I wrote. And so it was kind of already halfway there for me, you know, that here I had this voice, and this voice is so, you know, it's so present because it's, I preserved it. So for all of those reasons, I decided the best approach. Oh, no, and for one more reason, which is that there's such a glut of quote-unquote cult content in documentary, in memoir, in podcasts, for sure.
Right.
That there's something about telling it from the perspective of my childhood self that takes away a little bit of the sensationalism, because obviously inside of it, as a kid, I didn't think that I was in a cult. I didn't know what a cult was.
Right.
And I wasn't shocked and scandalized by child brides and, you know, all the weird stuff they were doing, because it just wasn't weird to me. And I also felt like it kind of created a buffer for that potential pitfall, which is that I didn't want to write a salacious tell-all memoir about that stuff, and because that's not how I experienced it.
That makes so much sense. And not to take anything away from other books of people like telling their experience of coming out of abusive situations as children, but the way that you framed it, we're really able to experience it alongside you. And I was just struck how well you could channel your younger self. And I think the diaries must have provided a window for you. Was it difficult to get into your old headspace?
Was it difficult? But I sort of covered in my author's note that because when I left the Lyman family as an 11 and a half year old, I always feel like saying and a half because in my mind that mattered a lot. You know, young.
And then it does.
Yeah. And because I always just wanted to be older. So when I left the Lyman family, I was incredibly, incredibly devastated. And because I was so devastated, I just replayed everything that ever happened to me over and over in my head in this kind of desperation to preserve the culture and the place that I came from and to not forget any single detail because I always wanted to be back. So I just kind of made a hard archive in my brain as a kid. And also I tried to write this book. Well, I tried to write about this in my fiction workshop in college. I just tried again in my 20s. I tried again in my 30s. I tried again in my 40s. So this has been brewing for a long time. And what the scenes would be and how the story would unfold has been always on my back burner. So it's something that's never let go of, because I always knew I would write a book. I just didn't know when or how or if I would ever have the courage. And by courage, I mean not so much that I feel like the people I grew up with would come for me in any literal way. But I was in good standing with them. And there's something about knowing that I would get their disapproval and how my generation would respond to me talking about this. That was very daunting.
And I don't think they'll be able to get the perspective of that you did take a less sensationalistic approach to it compared to other things that I've seen, other documentaries or other books that I've read. It's a sympathetic, but not, you're not excusing what they're doing, but you're also, because you're, as you said, you're coming to it from how you thought about it as a child, there's a lack of harsh judgment throughout your childhood there. You're trying to make sense of it as a child. So you're describing abusive situations or difficult things that I think would be embarrassing to the group, but you're not doing it from the perspective of a scolding or bitter adult, although you have every reason to scold or you had every reason to feel bitter about certain things. And so there's a sympathy, I guess, is what I'm saying, to your approach that comes through.
It's sort of an accidental sympathy. It's then of the people of my generation from this family that have reached out to me about the book, to a one, they say, you were so easy on them. you made it seem, you know, like so idyllic, and you didn't really get into that. Like some, I thought they were going to be mad at me for writing at all, but instead they were like, I was hoping for you to really skewer them. And I, to that I say, you may have lost perspective on what's normalized, what was normalized for us.
Right. And that's what you're doing.
Yeah. A person outside of us still sees, even though it's my kid perspective and it's, you know, a lot of the bad stuff that's happening is behind closed doors. They still see that this is disturbing. And what's even more disturbing is that me, the protagonist, is like, yeah, this is what life is like. I'm just trying to figure it out, you know?
Yeah. And it's brilliant to see how you grow. I mean, even in the language you're using, like there's a simplicity to your prose early on in the book as you're a child. There's a childlike innocence to it and curiosity. And then as we get into your teenage years, the angst and all of the emotion and your struggles come through, you start to swear. Like even the vocabulary you're using becomes advanced later on in the book. Like we see you, we kind of get to grow along with you. And it kind of let me read it on two levels. On the one, I could sort of imagine myself as a child in those situations. But I also was like, you know, obviously judging throughout and like reacting to shocking things from an adult perspective as well. But your book let me do both of those things. It let me kind of experience what you as a child experienced, but also like, so I could feel really sympathetic, but also totally ticked off at what some of the adults were doing. So we'll get into some details. We'll unwrap this for people. Let's go to January 5th, 1975. This is the day that you were taught the world was definitely going to end. You were 6 years old and you were told to get your favorite toy, put on your favorite clothes. There was a spaceship coming to pick you all up. The whole world was going to be destroyed because the world was wicked. And you waited all night and nothing. So what was that like to wake up to a day that wasn't supposed to exist as a six-year-old?
I think beyond the disappointment, because I was really looking forward to going to Venus and living there.
Yeah.
There was just anxiety and fear because I knew, and this is more like a gut feeling. It's like the adults all said something was going to happen and it didn't. This isn't going to be pretty. Whatever it is, you know, that they're going to have to save face. And I don't know that I was as sophisticated as a six-year-old to think of it in those terms, but I knew it wasn't going to be good. And that the idea of being in trouble was a huge kind of driving force for all of us as kids, because sometimes we would be in trouble for the most arbitrary things, you know, attributed to our astrological sign or something our parents did or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So in this case, and it turned out to be true, we were all in trouble. And we found that out pretty quickly. We were all in trouble because the leader of the cult said that it was our fault, our being the collective family, because our souls weren't ready. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, after being up all night and being disappointed about not moving to Venus, we also all had to contemplate how is it, I in particular thought it was me. Because it was like he didn't specify whose soul wasn't ready, but the implication was that there are a few bad apples that are ruining it for everyone. Yes. Certainly that we all ruined it for him because he was ready. And so it just kind of created this sort of collective sense of being in trouble and guilt and this free-floating anxiety. Like, how do I make my soul ready to live on Venus is one thing that most six-year-olds don't have to think about too much.
Right. I felt so bad for you. I did, because you internalized so much and you carried these burdens of guilt that were entirely out of proportion to who you actually were as a person. And there was no real substance to it. It was sort of like you said, it was very ethereal. It was like maybe an astrological sign thing, or maybe you were too defiant, or the leader of the cult had built this whole cosmology around the purpose of life was for you to come here and learn lessons, and to like you probably had lived multiple times and were like hadn't learned your lesson yet. And so you had this idea of constantly failing and that your life itself was, again, risking being a failure again, and now you've ruined the end of the world, which maybe someone else might have been happy about. Like, oh, that's kind of good that, like, billions of people won't die.
we weren't raised to even have that level of empathy for billions of people.
Right.
Yeah. To be clear to your listeners, I had been already told that, me personally, not just any of the kids, but me, that Earth was, we were all told Earth is school and we all are put here to learn, and we learn our lesson and we move on to fill in the blank. Don't know. Mm-hmm. Don't know if it was Venus. But I personally was told that I had kept coming back. Mm. So I was like, I made the joke. I was like the Matthew McConaughey character in Dazed and Confused, who's like the like guy in his 20s who still hangs out with the high school kids. Like, I was just like held back a grade, but several grades. And so I was, the minute I was, you know, conscious enough to understand that those concepts, I was looking for what it is that right. I kept failing at. And they called me the little 44-year-old, and part that was part and parcel of the fact that I was already so, I was just behind. I was born behind. Like, I was born getting it wrong.
Yeah. And you do come across as an old soul, too. It's funny. Like, when Jesse, who is kind of one of the main authority figures, a woman who you quite loved in many ways, when she coined that little 44-year-old, she was reacting to statements you had made and ways that you would write. And I have to say, like, the excerpts you include from your diaries really do, you come across as such an old soul. Like, it's true. Like, it seemed like they tapped into something about your personality and then fit it into their cosmology. Like, it would have made sense. You know, some kids do just kind of seem ahead of the other kids, or they're having thoughts that you wouldn't expect that kid to have. You seem like that kind of kid.
Yeah, and that's what's confusing about it. I was like, I do feel different from other kids. I do feel kind of more serious and more studious and more like, you know, it's chicken egg, I guess, really. But I definitely moved right into the 44-year-old identity. It's funny because there's a website called Goodreads where just lay people can read your book and write reviews and, you know, rate it and stuff. And this, it's very different from films, which is what I usually do, where you get a review from a critic, you get a bunch of reviews from a critic. This is just hundreds of people giving their opinion on my book, which is good and bad. Hard to look away. And one of the reviews, I just went and read all the one-star reviews. I just got it out of the way. And one of the reviews said, I feel like I'm just listening to the ramblings of a 9-year-old with a really good vocabulary. I guess the subtext there being that I made myself look smarter, more articulate, which would be such a corrupt thing to do in this context. To invent like a brainy little 9-year-old. I'm like, no, that's really what I wrote. I would never be so foolish as to even edit. Mostly not edit it. It's just excerpted.
Do you still have the physical diaries too, like the ones that you're quoting from?
Oh, yeah. It's sitting right over there.
Yeah, so there you go. I mean, I quite enjoyed living in that headspace with you. You really took me to that age. And, you know, okay, so when you don't go to Venus, later on you asked your mom what she was thinking, because now you know, okay, actually Venus isn't even habitable. Like, even if you could have gotten there, you all would have immediately died. Like, you can't survive there. And you asked her about this years later, and the only thing she could give you was, it's complicated. Like, she couldn't really go into it. So people might wonder how your own mom came to join this cult, which obviously got you into it as well.
My mother was 18 and pregnant with me in the fall of 67. And she was going to college in Boston. And the Lyman family, which is the name of the cult that I grew up in, had a magazine called The Avatar that they passed out. It was like a free magazine on the streets, newsletter kind of vibe. And she started reading it, and then she started working for the magazine. And then she realized that she was pregnant and that she could not go home. It would not be okay with her family. And I think that tipped the scales into her just living with the family. I think out of necessity, but also, like, everybody needs to be forgiving and think about 1969 and choices that any 19-year-old made. And you were either counterculture or you were the man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in an effort to be empathetic toward her choices, I often think to myself, if I was 19, pregnant or not, I probably would have done something very alternative rather than just, you know, live the straight life, you know?
Yeah. And so she gets into this, and you talk about how the idea of family with the Lyman family was different. How was family defined? These are your formative years, and your mom brings you into this place. And this was not the typical nuclear household at all. What was family like for the Lyman family?
Well, almost all of us kids weren't with our biological parents. Like, no, they had compounds around the country, and we would move among them willy-nilly, really. And and so by the time I was 3 or 4, I was separated from my mom. My mom worked on Wall Street. I know that sounds very incongruous, but she did. A lot of people led double lives like that. They worked one job and pretended to be just normies and then came home to listen.
That, like, funded the group, right?
Yeah, definitely. That was partially what funded the group, was people's incomes. And so what family meant was everyone, all 160 of us, and discipline, authority, et cetera, coming from anyone if you're a kid. And, you know, big group meals every night, a lot of, amazingly, even though it was the 70s, just such a tight-knit network of information and gossip and, you know, edicts that would come down, I guess, all from the phone. And you, when your family is also your only authority figures and are also your only source of education, it gets very murky very quickly. The boundaries, there are no boundaries, you know.
Yeah, you don't have an external world to really compare it against. So like when my kids started going to school, they're introduced to other authority figures that are very contextualized. There's teachers at school. There's other kids that they didn't grow up with. And they're able to sort of get different perspectives and like they can bring that home and say, oh, my home's like this, school's like this. You didn't really get that early on, really. I mean, your world was just bound into the, those people. That family was your world. And the teachings about the external world were that it was wicked and shameful and to be avoided.
Soulless.
So, yeah. And I mean, this is kind of what these high control groups do, right? Is disconnect people from outside, disconnect people from the ability to triangulate and maybe get a sense of their own identity compared to the group. Your identity really seemed subsumed by the group. And as you said, your mom was distant from you. And you, in some ways, were kind of taught to be, well, not taught, but you came to be ashamed of your mom because of power relationships that existed in the group. Talk about that a little bit. That seems to play a pretty big part in how you related to your mother.
So in the family, there was a very clear hierarchy. I should say those people at the top were always at the top. And then there was sort of like a mid-range of people who would be in and out of favor, but they still had more power. Mm-hmm. And then there were people like my mom. And FP, the guy that she eventually left the family with, who were just kind of worker bees, who had no power. And so for me, even though I was never with her, whatever her social status was kind of baggage. It's kind of like the military, really. I went to high school in the town adjacent to West Point. And it's weird because I was so familiar with the hierarchy because I would be like, that woman is so popular, but she's not that cute. Mm-hmm. She's nice. And I'm like, oh, her dad is the commandant of the military base. Uh-huh. And I would watch all these military kids and how they treated each other according to their parents' rank, usually their fathers. And I was, it's so familiar to me. So in my case, she was a social liability because if she did something that was not approved of, everybody knew about it and it would come back on me. And because her kind of rival, the woman who's kind of stole her man and then, you know, she got him back, hated me because of it, because I look a lot like my mom and I was always around. And so this woman just kind of, you know, did everything in her power to undermine me as a kid and to get me away from Jesse's orbit, which was the preferable place to be. So very complicated to have all of this kind of social status hanging on your mother, who you barely know. And in my case, to have a higher social status than my mother when I was 11.
Right. So these power relations play out through the book and the adults are kind of playing the kids off of their own issues. You became a pawn in this bigger game, really. And in the middle of that, you were on the farm. This is one of the properties. There was properties in Boston, New York, Kansas, I believe, and then also in Los Angeles. You were on the farm. So it's kind of a middle tier status place there. Things were going well. And Jesse, one of the highest power authorities, would travel amongst the communities, kind of with this little caravan. And they came through, and a young girl, Daria, was drawn to you. And you talk about how this is how you got pulled into the higher orbit, was this young girl took a shine to you. And so suddenly you found yourself leaving the farm, which it seemed like you quite loved. But now you're recognizing an elevation in your status, and that's exciting. You're actually going to go to Los Angeles with Jesse. This is a big career move for childhood you.
Yeah, definitely a step up.
And so in that process, your fate changes, and then you get wrapped up in all these other power relations, right? So let's talk about in LA, you became more aware of some troubling things that were going on in the family, especially when it came to the leader, Melvin Lyman, and underage girls. Throughout your life, you'd already been reading his writings and they would listen to tapes that he had made. So the ideology had already sort of been planted with you by the time you found out that he was involved with underage girls. And I thought it would be helpful if you could read an excerpt from one of Melvin's books to give people a sense of what you were being taught. This is on page 70 at the beginning of chapter 12. You excerpt something that Melvin wrote in Avatar, that publication that you had mentioned earlier. So if you can, it gets us Melvin's voice and also kind of his ideology here in really important ways.
All right. This is from Avatar, the publication I mentioned earlier, December 2nd, 1972. If a woman is really a woman and not just an old girl, then everything she does is for her man, and her only satisfaction is in making her man a greater man. She is his quiet conscience. She is his home. She is his inspiration, and she is his living proof that his life, his labors are worthwhile. A woman who seeks to satisfy herself is the loneliest being in God's creation. A woman who seeks to surpass her man is only leaving herself behind. A man can only look ahead. He must have somewhere to look from. A woman can only look at her man.
So as a child, what was this doing for you as you're encountering these ideas? How did you feel about this?
I believed it. I didn't dare not believe it. I think, obviously, what my perspective on it changed as I got older. But I mean, the funniest thing about all of his writing, because that's the kind of the most coherent or linear or whatever of the pieces that I choose, is that I always thought I would understand them when I was older, you know, and it was funny and interesting to go back and reread this book and a lot of his writings as I was writing my own book. I mean, like, you know what, little girl? You're going to be 55 years old and you're still not going to know what the fuck it's talking about. Let yourself off the hook. It doesn't really fully make sense. But in this case, which is very, it's very clear and obviously incredibly sexist and misogynist and patriarchal. I think I was at that point just thought, you know, oh, someday I'll have a man that I can be all of that for.
Yeah, it's a benevolent patriarchy thing, right? It's presuming to elevate women by infantilizing and making them subservient to men, but praising them for that, right? This is your purpose. This is how you can excel. I just can't imagine what that would be like as a kid to imbibe that sort of thing.
I mean, and the crazy thing about the story is that Jesse, who was really had the most power as when I was growing up, would say similar things. I think when Jesse said things, I think often the subtext was, except me, but I'm special. Because she served no man. I mean, she would make a big performance out of serving the guy that she was with. And you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, I made Richie lunch. But you know what I mean? It was not, in no way was it required of her. It was kind of like, this is my man, in quotes. Or I could fire him and have any man I want.
Exactly. A ton of power at the top. I also wanted to have you read a little excerpt here from your diary on page 95. This will give people a sense of your young voice. And again, as we talked about, you're an old soul. You're an 11-year-old in this. This is in April of the year 4.
Yes.
And the year 4, because that was 4 years after the world didn't end.
April 10, 04, which was actually 1979. Life is an eternal passage of change. Every time you take a step, you think, oh God, this has to be the last one. I can't go any further. But there is always something more that you haven't discovered. Tomorrow will be yesterday, once yesterday was tomorrow. And tomorrow and yesterday are sometimes today. And today goes on in the same way until it is yesterday again.
I loved it. It's so, like, it's actually pretty beautiful. It's pretty moving stuff. I know it's a little cliche and silly in some ways too, but I don't know. There's something about your voice here. It's funny to me that they were having you read the ramblings of Melvin Lyman that were just, as you said, some of them are just like bonkers. And here you are able to string together some really beautiful stuff. I think it's really touching.
But to be honest, sometimes when I read pieces like this in my diary, I feel like I'm actually emulating his writing.
So it's performative.
You know, I'm like, I can be a little bit deep and a little bit obtuse too. Like that's what that's like what everybody, the writing that everybody reveres. So let me take a hand at a stab at this genre.
I mean, I wish as an 11-year-old, you could have just been watching cartoons or something too. Like, oh man. Yeah, this does get a little deep. That's interesting. Like as you read it back, you get to remember, you see your performance, right? You get to see your performance a little better.
Yes. And one interesting and important thing to note about these diaries is that there was always the possibility that someone else would be reading them. So Laura's, it's sort of a weird document because it's performative and yet needs to feel like it isn't. So at a very young age, I was really tweaking a very, very tricky little genre slash towing this line between making it seem personal, but also if anyone read it being like, wow, she feels really bad for what she did, or she really loves so-and-so or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Somewhere in the book, somewhere in my journals, and I put it in the book, I said I really missed someone. And I said, and not in the way that you do when you just write it in a letter to fill up space. And I was like, wow, I must have told a lot of people I missed them, and when I did it.
Yeah, I totally miss you. Well, one person you might have said it to was your biological mom, right? Because they had you visit her sometimes, and it was such an awkward thing for you because you really didn't know this woman. And for all intents and purposes, she wasn't really your mom, but yet she kind of was. And so you had to enact a sort of like love and regard for her when you didn't genuinely feel it. So maybe that was one of the people that you'd be like, I miss you.
I'm sure.
When in reality, you're like, I don't know you.
I'm sure that we'd said, especially when I had to talk to her on the phone. I always, whenever people ask me.
Oh, yeah, the phone.
I'm very avoidant of talking on the phone. And way before and this digital age we're in, because the only time I would ever talk on the phone would be awkward conversations with my mother. When I was a kid, we had no shared experience.
No.
And so it would just be like, hi, what'd you do today? I miss you. We had like, it was really tense. So yeah, it was a very, the biggest shock to me, one of the times they sent me to visit her in New York, was seeing a photo of me framed on her office desk.
At work, yeah.
At her job. And how it never occurred to me that she was openly lying about her real life to her coworkers, and you know, which was most of her life. It was a Wall Street job. She worked insane hours. And I just thought it was one of my first reckonings with the fact that we were raised to believe that truth was the ultimate. It was just essential to living, you know, a real life, a connected life, the right kind of life. And yet they were lying all around us to the outside world. Right. So, you know, this is so important. Do as I say, not as I do.
Right. And you walk us through how your 11 or, you know, young mind sort of dealt with that cognitive dissonance. You're saying here in the book, you said it had been drilled into our heads that lying was bad, but it was okay to lie to world people. Like you were trying to make sense. Oh, so maybe this is the, you had to make sense of it. It had to make sense. And so you, here you are making meaning while you were so confused and seeing the world people would blow your mind. They're, like one time you were watching Sesame Street and you saw them talking about this, the most important person, like this little segment, and it showed little kids playing and blowing out birthday candles and things like this. And the song said, the most important person in the whole wide world is you, and you hardly even know you. And you said, like, you were so scandalized. You're like, oh, wow, like how egotistical, like that did not land with
I think you. Anyone who's my age and who had access to television will remember the song, the most important person in the whole wide world is you, and you're hard to really know it, something like that. It was very catchy.
The most important person in the whole wide world is you, and you hardly even know you. The most important person in the whole wide world is you. Come on, we'll show you. Let's find out more about the things you feel and do. You're the most important person in the world to you.
Yeah, but I just thought, God, these world people are messed up. Like, they're just, like, telling kids how important they are. Yeah. Like, what? No wonder the world is a mess.
Yeah. And so, yes, you're experiencing the world in these little glimpses. But then back home, so now you're with Jesse's group. You're in the internal circle there, and you're really getting elevated there. There's a night when Jesse is so affectionate towards you and just says, you're going to be Miss America. She's really praising you and saying that you're beautiful and that you'll be Miss America. And it became like a real thing. It wasn't like a thing you might say to play with a kid. It seemed like you kind of got it into your head that that was an actual possibility. It seemed like.
Oh, and they meant it. They meant it. They were just waiting for me to be old enough. Yeah.
And that ticked off Delia. This was the other woman who was really jealous of you. And as you said, there was some things between your mom and a partner that they had both had and infidelity that was happening. And so Delia wants you out, basically. She's going to do everything she can to get you out of this inner circle.
Yeah, and Delia was really, she was Jesse's kind of right-hand woman in slash lady-in-waiting in the way that I was Daria's, Jesse's daughter. You know, we were sort of the lesser beings who were invited to be in this orbit. And I think she also just didn't want any more lowly people to be elevated and be standing next to her. Just like, get out of here. I'm the success story.
It's a scarcity mindset, it sounds like, too. If her story is that she was an elevated lower person, then you would be a direct threat to that. Like, you might displace her. This is how power relations and this is how family relationships seemed to work within this family. And I think people who didn't grow up in a cult or people who grew up sort of in a dysfunctional family will actually relate a lot to some of the dynamics that you describe here. The way that adults can play kids off of each other. Parents do this sometimes in their own power struggles. And so seeing her from this scarcity mindset seeing you as a threat, a child as a threat, and treating you so poorly. Some of the things she did to you, I'm telling you, I would get so mad reading your book. And what was powerful was you weren't connecting the dots about it. You weren't saying, look how abusive this was. Look how messed up this was. Or saying, like, this is how it affected my life today. Or I still have a trouble maintaining intimacy or whatever. You don't get into that. You just tell us from your kid perspective and you let us as the reader have to process it. And I think that was a really powerful authorial choice on your part, because I'm just hearing you say it and then I have to process it. You're not doing that work for me.
I feel like a part of the reason I chose to tell the story this way also is that I didn't want sympathy, and I didn't want to feel self-indulgent, or for the reader to feel that it was self-indulgent. Pardon me. And I feel like letting the reader fill in the blanks. I'm like this as a screenwriter too. Letting the absorber of the art to fill in the blanks has more power in a way, because you're bringing, I'm sure, a lot of what you personally brought and how you would feel.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's catharsis in hearing you talk about what it was like. So I think people that have experienced abusive situations can find catharsis here. And it's not a self-help book. You're not giving advice about how people can reckon with their violence in their past. You're just bearing witness to it. And sometimes bearing witness and telling the story is enough. I think that is the power of film, because otherwise it gets preachy. I think it gets a lot more dated. It probably can reach fewer people overall because you're not giving space. This is actually where Melvin Lyman was kind of brilliant, I think. Like, his opaqueness and sort of throwing all these ideas out gave people the ability to fill some of it in, even though he was so high controlling. I think that's how stories work best, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. It really is. I have had an incredible response from survivors of all kinds, and that has been gratifying. And then from a category of response, too, is from friendly acquaintances, people I know who've read the book, writing me like, you know, I had to put it down because I was sobbing too hard. And I'm thinking to myself, on the one hand, that means I wrote it effectively. On the other hand, am I out here writing books to make acquaintances sob?
Yeah. What did you think about that then? Like, if people are reacting to that, what would you say to your friend to be like, oh, you're crying? Oh, sorry about that.
I say, you know? Sorry. I make the joke that I wanted to call the book Trigger Warning.
But
my editor wasn't having it.
Yeah.
And I think that the sneaky thing about my book is that you're kind of braced in the first half for what horrible thing is going to happen in this cult. And a lot of emotionally devastating things happen, but they're just emotionally devastating things that are, you know, they're not physical, and they're not like what we associate with what the salacious details of a cult would be. Mm-hmm. But then my life gets so much worse, and it is full of abuse and violence, and at the hands of, you know, ostensibly a nuclear-shaped family.
And that's exactly where we're going. This is like the second family model that you lived in was more the traditional, seemingly nuclear family. So you're going to get kicked out. You are going to get kicked out of the family. And this is because your mom decides to leave, and you tell the story of how you found out. And since she decided to leave with her then partner, who is called FP in the book. And by the way, is that what they went by really, or is that a pseudonym?
FP was not his name. He's dead.
Okay.
I just didn't want to look at his name and then say his name in a million interviews and conversations.
Okay.
And so I just named him FP, which is a personal joke to me because it stands for f***ing psycho.
Oh, okay. Okay. And as people will find out, it's also it's kind of on the nose, actually. As a writer, I'm surprised.
Days and days of workshopping to come up with initials that would amuse me. Now it's kind of great because also in my family, his name comes up because he's the father of two of my siblings. And so now everyone calls him FP. So now I don't have to hear his name ever again. It was a particularly effective little decision that I made.
Okay, so you're called up to the big house. You know you're in trouble. They tell you there that you have to go, and because your mom is leaving. And so now they say, if you don't have a biological parent here, we can't keep you here. You can choose to come back. They left the door open in a way. And then, so you're being sent to live with a mother who you didn't really know, and you were actually kind of ashamed of. And this is where you introduce us to FP. She was your mom's partner, and they left the group together. Here you are in this nuclear family, and this, as you said, is where the real abuse begins. When you get into this seemingly more normal family, things actually got a lot worse for you. Not only are you beginning to be abused at home, but you're also expected to just jump right into public school as well. This must have been an overwhelming transition for you. Talk a little bit about what it was like to be in this new family structure and to be thrown into the, quote, world, which you had always been taught to have contempt for.
Well, I immediately, and I mean like the night of the day that I was dropped off out into the world and with my mom, I immediately wanted to go back, and I knew it. And everything that was happening to me, I was saying, it doesn't really matter. I'm leaving anyway. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, mm-hmm. a couple of months go by and it's finally they've got it all together so I can enroll in a school. And I'm like, I'm just going to go for a couple of weeks. Especially once I got to the school, because I was such a weirdo. So I was immediately bullied. The girls were really nice to me. The boys were really mean, and some of the girls were mean. But also, I just looked really different. I acted really different. I didn't know things that were really basic. I didn't know pop music. I didn't know pop culture. My hair was down to my butt in an era in 1979 when everyone's hair was aspirational to Farrah Fawcett. I didn't have any designer jeans. I wore skirts all the time, so culty. And I stood out like a sore thumb, not only because I was the new girl in late October, but I was very conflicted because I loved the fact that there was school and it was structured and I was learning things and I was clearly emerged as the kid who would get the best grade, which, you know, bored resentment, but also just attention and sometimes a request to cheat. It was social currency in a way. And also because the home life had already revealed itself to be on a path to hell, was already violent and was moving into some sort of sexual violence. I was just so happy to be at school because I was free. I could pretend that my life wasn't my life and that I'd just focus on learning and making friends. And I was also just kind of being like, world people seem, some of them are really nice. Like, I don't understand. Like, I don't feel like I'm in a dangerous place when I'm here at school. I feel like I'm in a great place. And, you know, and I was a little too self-possessed to really take the bullying very personally. It was kind of a bummer, but I didn't care if they called me Gwenna queer, whatever. How did they know I was going to grow up to be gay? I don't know. I don't think they meant queer in that sense, but they definitely called me Gwenna queer, and it didn't hurt my feelings. I thought it was funny. It was a little like aggravating because the boys just worked so hard to make my life miserable. And I'm just like, ugh, I don't even want to think about boys. Ha, grew up to be gay.
Yeah, we get to see you really find yourself. And you have diaries from this part of your life, too. And it's so interesting to see you kind of going back and forth about like, oh, the world people. Oof, and then saying stuff like, oh, the world people. And also, I feel like the Lyman Group sort of tried to poison the well. Like they would say like, oh, you're probably going to become a world person. Just as a heads up, you're totally going to do it. And that, of course, motivated you to be like, no, I'm not. Like you were going to hang on to it. But we see you start let go of the rope. And you say stuff like, well, you know, I'm going to start wearing pants and I'm going to do this. And, you know, I think it's going to be okay. But I'm definitely going to go back to the fan. Like I'm not losing myself. And so we see you justifying to yourself and talking to yourself through your diaries about these changes in your life. And again, this parallels the increasing violence at home. So this is where you're pretty specific about how FP began to sexually assault you. You're coming into your teenage years. What was it like writing about this? Did you know that this was something you wanted to share? Or did you have to come to terms with that as you were writing the book?
I always knew I wanted to share the abuse and share it in kind of as sort of non-expletive but bald truth as I could style-wise. I just feel like I don't like narratives about abuse, especially when it's girls, when it's female people at the hands of men. I don't like the vague language doesn't feel, it feels like a complicity in the power structure and the, you know, the transgression. Whereas just being like, you know what, if you're flinching right now as you're reading this, imagine what it actually felt like and imagine trying to keep that, having to keep that secret, or imagine your mother knowing about it and letting it continue. I just felt like an unflinching look at the actual details. You know, people just say sexual abuse and you know everyone in their mind is being like, what kind? At what level? You know, what is, and make people think to themselves, like, what's my idea of rape? Like, what's the line? What's worse this sex act or this sex act, or isn't it all bad? So I feel like there's a power in naming it really specifically and saying, you know, if you don't think this was that bad, then you're wrong. But you can't, you know, again, it's just like just diving into it. So I always knew I wanted to write about it. It was very hard to write, but just because I had to go back there and just finding the words for it was hard. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it's so hard to not make it creepy. It is creepy. When I was writing the proposal for the book, I deliberately made myself write a chapter that it explicitly included abusive moments to see if I could do it. And then because, you know, the editors that I met with when I eventually chose the editor that I have, to see how they would handle it. Because I did, because I was ready to write this book. But what I was not ready for was handling someone else's feelings while I needed, well, all I needed was an editor. So it was, and so it was hard to write, but I was also like, I can do that and I'm still alive. Like, okay, well, that was one of the hardest things and it's already partially written and here we are. I mean, the only voice in my head as I'm writing this thing, voices in my head as I'm writing the, those particular things are my younger brother and sister, because it's their father I'm talking about. I mean, this book is their horrible parents that I'm talking about, one of them being mine. And so that was a reckoning that took, I wrote it, you know, in 2020 probably. I didn't get, they didn't read it till this year, obviously, because I wasn't done yet. And luckily, they're both dealing with it.
Did they experience any abuse like that themselves, or?
A lot of violence.
I guess maybe that's not their story to tell, but.
And I don't think that either of them would mind if I said that he was very violent and controlling with them. But, you know, a very different brand of psychopathy, really. But,
okay.
You know, a cousin to it. They didn't have a great experience with him at all growing up, and they had to live with him even more than I did because they actually grew up with him. He passed away in December of 2021, and at first I was like, bummer. I kind of wanted this book to be out in the world with him having to deal with it. And then I was like, actually, no. Actually, it's he probably, of everyone that I mentioned in this book that might take issue, he might be the only one who would actually try to sue. So that would just been a hot mess and off topic. Although I think anyone, this I've been living with this hope, anyone who would try to sue me for this would know that that would just be really good publicity.
Yes, the Barbra Streisand effect is real. So again, so you are clear about what happened to you. I also appreciate it. Again, you're writing from your teenage perspective. So we get to see the internal struggles that you had about, like, in some ways, engaging in some of the sexual abuse or being there for that could forestall physical violence or other types of problems. And you learned and were groomed to sort of participate that way, which could make someone feel guilty or complicit. And you talk about all the mixed feelings that you had. Obviously, you were always disgusted and always hated it. But to see what it does to a young person was really powerful. It's a powerful witness, I think. It certainly shed more light on what that kind of abuse would be like. As a reader, I was appreciative, and it was hard to read, but I was appreciative because it helped me understand even more the kind of things that happen to real people in the world.
What's interesting to me is that I don't know what made me so afraid of the foster care system. But I did know that if I went to some kind of authority and talked about the abuse that I was suffering, that I would, worst case scenario, no one would believe me and nothing would happen. And then I would live in a household where I had tried to get out, which would have made it exponentially worse. Or I would be put into foster care. And I don't know how I knew this, but I knew that it might be the same thing all over again, but just with new devil I didn't know, you know. And so it's a mystery to me what my decisions were, except that I know that I lived an incredibly compartmentalized life in which I spent my time at school and anywhere but home, not just pretending it wasn't happening, like believing it wasn't happening, like knowing it in my bones, like just put that away, because it's so much more fun to be this version.
I also think that the family models that you were living in, you had a comparison, like you had your previous family sort of system and structure, which had its own dysfunctions and issues, but it was safer than what you experienced in this apparently nuclear family situation. So I can't imagine that would be a very ringing endorsement of, your stereotypical American family life, now that you had lived that yourself, you're probably looking back at the family and saying, I really do want to get back there. That was better for me.
I think one of the things that emerged for me as what I was writing about, aside from just myself and my life, was that the nuclear family can be just as destructive as a cult, and that that the average cult is just patriarchy on steroids, especially because FP was really trying to replicate that life, but in microcosm and in the middle of the real world, that it's, you know, it's kind of an indictment of the nuclear family accidentally.
Yeah. Yeah, or at least a call to reckon, I think, is what I would call it. It's like, at no point did I feel like any sort of wholesale condemnation of any particular structure. What you were doing was calling attention to the kind of power dynamics and abuses that can play out regardless of the structure and how they might be different based on what the structure is. So when we're thinking about what family means to someone, even someone like me, who I didn't grow up in a cult, but I could, like you did, I could recognize certain things in what you described, in how adults in my life acted, or some of them acted, or in elements of what your little mom, dad, kid family, how that looked. So I wanted you to read one excerpt before we get to the last part of the interview here on page 242. This is the last paragraph in this chapter, and this is when you finally decide to really leave. FP had physically assaulted you. He had slammed your head against a bedboard repeatedly and just really physically harmed you. And your mom had kind of begun blaming you or being even jealous of you when she found out the abuse was happening, or thinking that you were maybe egging it on or something. You were just done at that point. So if you can read that last paragraph.
The thing about violence is that it's not something that could be happening every second. Lives have to be lived. Houses of cards have to be reconstructed. I imagine they both told themselves lies to get up the next morning. I imagine I told myself a few as well. Who will I call to get the homework assignment while I miss school was an easier question than, what's to become of us? The deep undercurrent of my defiance informed every moment inside the house after that. I knew I'd upset the balance, but I still didn't know how to escape. I want to say there was no more sexual abuse, but that would be a lie. I probably did what I was coerced into doing because, though the violence saved me from sexual abuse, it kept me from school, and school was my only portal to freedom. I had to go to school. A few days later, I was allowed to wear makeup for the first time to cover up what was left of the bruises. That was pretty good.
Yeah, that line, the thing about violence is that it's not something that can be happening every second. Lives have to be lived. I could apply that line to not just violence, but to so many things. I think that applies to grief, when you're grieving the loss of a loved one. Like, lives have to be lived. It can even be your joy can be interrupted by the everyday thing. Like, every strong thing we experience, lives still have to be lived. And when it came to violence, I think it was such an important point for you to make, and it really stopped me in my tracks, because we're in the violence with you so much. You're describing it in depth, but you're also saying, look, I'm also living a life. Like, there was school, there were friends that I had, there was other stuff. And it just, I just loved that line, especially. Very powerful.
Thank you. It's a thing that I have thought about a lot, sort of the mundanity of, you know, and it applies too to the family that I grew up in, you know, the cult part of it, is that, you know, I was thinking about, I'm doing an adaptation now, a screenplay of this book. Mm. And I was like, I kind of just want a 20-minute scene where we're just doing laundry.
Mm-hmm. Well, Better Call Saul does this really well. There are shows that do these slow burn things, because streaming, I guess, they can like do these sprawling episodes. I love that, though. Sitting in the mundane aspects of a life, really, I think this is the power of prestige TV today, that they can do that. And I don't know if you've seen The Bear. They do it a little bit differently. They do all these like jump cuts of just scene. So you see like building, cutting food, do. And it's super rapid, but it's making you think of like all the other stuff that's happening while the story of The Bear is happening. So there's different ways, I think, to do it in film. There's the Better Call Saul way, which is like, they're going to show him doing something for like 3 minutes. And you're just going to be like, okay, like, why are we still here? Or there's the super jump cut. In your book, I think you're able to do it in a paragraph like the one you just read, where you remind us, like, okay, step out of the book for a second and recognize that you're getting a snapshot of what was going on here. So there's a lot of power to that.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like also there's power, as I think about the cinematic version of this, in if you already know you're in an environment that could erupt in violence at any time, you can imagine that a five-minute scene watching a bunch of kids do laundry, if you've set it up properly, mm-hmm. can feel menacing.
Totally.
Like, any second now, the hammer's going to come down, and we're not really sure from where or why, but, like, yes. these kids are always kind of in danger.
And by the way, how exhausting. I kept thinking to myself, what an exhausting life that must be for FP. The amount of control he leveraged, and how you and your mom had to walk on eggshells and think of him in so many ways, how just controlling he was. I feel like that would be an exhausting life to live, to try to exercise that level of psychological control over other people. I can't really wrap my head around that.
Yeah, I think about that sometimes, and I think about how much he plotted and schemed, and how much what it felt like was it was like a sociopathic animal. Like, it's just instinct. He's just going on this sort of weird, you know, manipulative person that probably comes from his own messed up childhood,
yeah.
and he's not even doing it on a fully conscious level.
Like, it's he's surviving too.
Yeah, he believed. I think it comes from this place where he just believed that he was right, and he believed that he was doing what the Lyman family would have done, but in microcosm. And his model, because you know he was 19 when he joined that family. His model was all powerful men who do whatever they want, and women serve them.
There's one more family model that you introduce us to in the book that you encountered, and this is a boyfriend that you had in high school, and this is one of the ways you escaped, is you were able to go to this home. His father, Lloyd Spears, he was 65 years old, and they take you in. How did that family contrast with the other family structures that you had encountered so far in your life?
That family, Lloyd was divorced, and so their mom lived far away, but it was Lloyd, Brian, my boyfriend, and his brother and sister, who were in and out of the house. They didn't really live there. I mean, they were slightly dysfunctional in the sense that, you know, the dad drank a lot, and everybody was always fighting with the sister. But mostly my experience was it was just me and Lloyd in the house. And Lloyd was a lovely man. And so suddenly I had this utterly benign, benevolent man who agreed to adopt me and barely asked me any questions and never did again, and was nothing but lovely to me. Mm. And, you know, for me, a safe man was almost an oxymoron.
Yeah.
And so I was just moved and thrilled. And I mean, if I was writing this story and it was fiction, I would say, God, that particular thing where her boyfriend's father just decides to adopt her, it comes a little too easily.
Yeah.
Didn't really work that hard for that. And I mean, it did because I worked so hard to find something.
Yes.
And I finally found that. But that was just, I did not know this man. Yeah. And he agreed to let me come live with them. And then on the spot, when cops came to take me away, he said he was going to adopt me. And then he did. Like, that's just magic fairy tale ending,
yes.
You know?
Yeah. And it's funny to me that the so-called, like, you know, stereotypical broken home, right? This is a divorced man, a little bit dysfunctional with his kids. He maybe has a problem with alcohol, but he ends up being such a safe place for you. And so as we're going through the book and seeing these different families, we have the Lyman family with all its dysfunction and difficulties. You introduce us to some nuance there for all of its real serious problems. But then your nuclear family, quote unquote, that's just not safe for you at all. And then this, what you'd look at as a, quote, broken home that becomes such a good place for you and a safe place for you, which to me, again, says don't judge a family by its cover. Like, looking at the outside, if we just look at the numbers and what was statistically likely to happen within those family structures, we would not have predicted the experience that you actually had. Your experience shows that different families work differently, and we've got to take each family one at a time to see what it's really like for people.
Yeah. My editor, when I wrote the piece about Lloyd and the cops coming in, at some point Lloyd puts his hand on my shoulder just for reassurance. And my editor was like, she goes, you got to let the audience off the hook. You got to let them know that this is not also going to be a predator. She's like, my heart jumped into my throat when he put his hand on your shoulder. And I was like, but that means I did my job.
Yeah.
because that means that at this point in the reader's experience, you know, like I need to be careful of all men.
See, that's so funny because it shows my male perspective here, because that was a moment of relief for me. I remember reading that part and thinking my initial thought was, at last, like someone is giving her like an actual genuine affectionate touch here that is one of safety. And so to have other readers react to that, their alarm bells would go off, I think says a lot about my own privilege and about like the kind of things that I don't really have to worry about. Because that was a moment of relief for me. Like, you set Lloyd up to be the character that he was. And I think maybe I just needed that relief of like, okay, things are finally going to be okay for Guinevere, please. Like, I've wanted it to be okay so much.
One friend of mine who's a woman said that she's like, I resisted crying for the whole book, but I cried with relief once Lloyd said he was going to adopt you.
Yeah. That's quite the moment in the book. And I want listeners to know, too, there's so much that we obviously didn't have time to cover throughout. And I was so engrossed, I forgot to reintroduce you to our listeners, too. So right now, I'll just remind people, this is Guinevere Turner. She's an acclaimed screenwriter and director. She co-wrote screenplays for American Psycho and the notorious Betty Page. And more recently, the screenplay for Charlie Says. She also wrote and starred in the film Go Fish and was a writer and actor on Showtime's The L Word, which is a title that she came up with herself as well. And she wrote an essay about these life experiences in The New Yorker that became the inspiration for this memoir that we're talking about today. The memoir is called When the World Didn't End. It is a powerful book. I quite enjoyed reading it, Guinevere. And before we go, it's time to talk about regrets, challenges, and surprises. So this is when you can choose to speak to one, two, or all three of these things. Is there something you would change about the book now that it's out? Is there something that was most challenging in writing it? And we've kind of talked a little bit about that, perhaps. And then was there any new revelations for yourself, any surprises as you were writing the book that you discovered in that process?
Regrets. I wish that I had changed more of the names of my generation, the girls that I talk about, specifically the ones who experienced some form of abuse, or so I thought, because one of them called me and said, I wish you'd change, you know, she liked the book a lot, but she said, I wish you'd change my name. And then she called me 2 weeks later and said, I'm glad you used my name. One of the challenges that I had, this is the challenge regret hybrid. One of the challenges I had was there are two things that I didn't put in the book because they are information that would hurt people's feelings who are still alive and who I still care about. I know that's hard to imagine, but if you read the book, like, what the heck did you not put in there?
Yeah.
But there are two different instances where I obscure the truth because it's, you know, someone's dad that I'm talking about, but it's someone that, you know, I'm in touch with today. Or because, not my sibling's dad, obviously, FBI just went for it. and so that part, like, it still hurts a little bit because I had to make a choice there between the artist who knows that this would just make the story better because it's just like, really? And just saying, like, you know what, I can't, like, that it's not worth it to hurt these feelings and potentially rupture these friendships. That was a challenge because the storyteller in me was like, no, like, don't come this far and then not say it all. And that's sort of an ethical thing that I think happens when you're, you know, writing memoir. And surprises, I'll tell you, my friend Claire giving me like, oh, do you think these letters that you wrote to me when you were 15 and all these audio tapes would be useful to writing your book? Like, that was an incredible surprise. And I was already, you know, toward the end of writing the book when I was like, yes.
Wow.
And there's just one of the letters I wrote to her is I published in its entirety in the book because my voice, I got so snarky by the time I was 15, even though my life was absolute hell. I'm still kind of like, what the fuck? And the audio tapes are priceless. They're just priceless. I will definitely give them to whatever young actor ends up playing teenage me. That was a surprise. I'm trying to think. I had one other thing. Oh, I was really surprised. This is maybe off topic, but it's not because I learned something. You know, when you have a book like this and with a big publisher, you go through a legal process. with, you know, like a legal read where they say, you know, who can verify this? Who can verify that? Mm-hmm. This, you should change this name for, you know, fear of being sued. And a thing I learned I did not know, so Delia, who's kind of an important figure in the book, that is not her real name. Mm.
This is Jesse's number two that we talked about that had the
power
struggle.
And she, you know, she was kind of forced to get an abortion that she didn't want. And the legal team said, you need to obscure her name because... Mm. And I was like, but everybody knew this. Like, literally 160 people knew this. It's not like, you know, and I learned, she said, the most actionable thing in terms of people suing for a memoir is revealing medical history. Hmm. Who knew? Hmm.
Probably like HIPAA law. Maybe there's probably just law around protected health info that is more robust. And
So I was surprised to learn that. I was surprised to learn what the subtleties are. I was surprised at myself in that process too, because I changed the name of a couple of people who were abusive just because I didn't want it to come back at me. Mm-hmm. And she said, why would you change the name of the abusers and not the victims or survivors? Mm. And I was like, oh, God, yeah, right. Mm. I'm going to do that too.
Yeah, that again speaks to like these ingrained power dynamics that happen of like people being more ready to protect abusers or to, you know, or to think of or to protect ourselves from abusers, even like
and I'm keenly and in great complexity aware of predator and survivor dynamics and, you know, cultural moments and all of it. And even I was like out here projecting, not on purpose, but actually enacting behavior that was protecting perpetrators and not victims. Yeah. And I was like, who am I?
Yeah. Well, as I said, there's so much we didn't cover. You get a swing by the family at the end of the book for one more pass to see maybe you'll go back and stick around. It doesn't pan out. Readers can pick up a book to find out what happened in your last journey back through the family. The book's called When the World Didn't End. I highly recommend it. And Guinevere, this was such a great conversation. And
I loved your book. And I appreciate you taking time to visit us.
Thank you so much, Blair. I really love the idea of your podcast. And as a person who has had so many different kinds of families and family structures, and it goes on. I went on to go to Sarah Lawrence College, which is a very small school where all sorts of intricate family structures. And then, you know, I work in film production where, you know, a very intense team becomes a family. Like, I seem to seek out different kinds of family structures. And then the queer community and families we choose.
Yes.
You know, there's just family is such a juicy, a fertile ground for a conversation and talking about our society in general.
Yeah.
So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about family and my very special relationship to it.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Relationscapes. It's a journey through the terrain of family, gender, and sexuality. We're mapping out the stories and ideas that shape how we connect with each other. And speaking of connecting with each other, go to Apple Podcasts, leave a review so that other people might connect with the show. You can also rate the show in Spotify. We'd really appreciate that. Any kind of feedback's great. I love hearing from you. Thanks to Mates of State for providing the theme song. It's called Somewhere. You can find that in Apple Music or wherever else you get your music. It's a great new single from them. Relationscapes is part of the Dialogue Podcast Network. I'm Blair Hodges, and I'll see you next time.
Dialogue Podcast Network.